Verizon Online and Store Office, or Center, meaning a monitor that's trusted as police, the real Lake County Attorney, or the Attorney of the Houston County Attorney.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name again is David Oblon. I represent Verizon. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
How long?
3 minutes, Your Honor.
All right, now hold on. Madam Clerk, you need to restart the clock.
Thank you. The Virginia Tax Commissioner had ruled that Verizon should not be taxed on set-top boxes and had ordered refunds for tax years 2008, 2009, and 2010. The trial court affirmed the tax commissioner's ruling that it wasn't properly taxed, but held that Verizon had missed the statute of limitations for two of those tax years, 2008 and 2009, and that it lacked jurisdiction to consider those and therefore refused to order a refund for those two tax years. A horrible appeal back to the circuit court, and we appealed up here, and that's where we are now. Under a relevant tax statutes, the tax commissioner acts as a trial court, and the circuit court acts as a court of appeals for those decisions. Verizon didn't miss the statute of limitations, and the trial court was wrong to reverse the Virginia tax commissioner's opinion for those two tax years. And there's two ways to appeal a tax assessment. The first is an administrative procedure under 3983.1 for the one-year statute of limitations. And the second is an appeal directly to the circuit court under 3980 with a three-year statute of limitation. And Verizon filed under both sections with Commissioner Horrible on December 28, 2010. Horrible considered the issues, on July 14, 2011, issued a final determination. He was required to do three things. He was required to undertake a full review of our claim. He's required to tell us his facts and arguments for the basis for his decision, and he's required to advise us of our appeal rights. He didn't do those three things with relation to the statute of limitations. He stayed silent, that was all a violation of statute. Now, had he told us he was denying our appeal on the basis of a missed statute of limitations, even as Horrible defines the statute of limitations, we clearly would have had time to go directly to the circuit court under the three-year statute of limitation period. But despite two required opportunities for him to tell us that he was objecting to our appeal on the basis of statute of limitations, both our appeal to him and our appeal to the tax commissioner, he stayed silent, lay in waiting, and only once he lost before the tax commissioner did he then say, you missed the statute of limitations. But even if Horrible hadn't waived the statute of limitations, Verizon was timely for 2008 and 2009 on the theory that when Horrible did take his second look at our assessment, that itself was a new assessment from which we could appeal and the timeline started fresh. Before I go on, the standard review on this is de novo because this was a summary judgment. There are no facts in dispute. So the first question is waiver. Did he waive, and could he waive? As far as did he waive, he waived in three different ways. He failed to raise jurisdiction, as I just mentioned. He failed to preserve jurisdiction as an appeal issue.
But we have to be careful with the word jurisdiction. You obviously cannot waive an objection to subject matter jurisdiction, but you can waive an objection to active jurisdiction, which is simply the legal authority to go forward in the case. So it's theoretically possible that if this particular statute of limitations were construed as removing subject matter jurisdiction by the tax commissioner, then it couldn't be waived. But that's a pretty hard argument for anyone to make, that a statute of limitation is a subject matter jurisdiction defeating device.
That's correct, Justice Kelsey. Both us and Horrible and clearly agree with your statement of the law that there are two forms of statute of limitations. One's waivable, one's not, pure or procedural, and there's a few others. Our position, of course, is that this is a pure statute of limitations that can be waived. And we know that it can be waived because 801.235 is a statute that says that no statutory limitation period shall have jurisdictional effect. I understand the exceptions that you've raised aside. And the key in determining whether this is the difference between a pure or a procedural statute is if the right and the remedy are combined in the same statute. If that's the case, it's procedural and it cannot be waived. If they are separated, as in with our case, then it can be waived.
I guess, actually, I'm getting at a finer point. The the special versus non-special or pure statute of limitations concept tells you whether you have to raise it as an affirmative defense for pleading purposes, or it gets waived. But it's a much larger question to ask, is the statutory limitation period, whatever it might be, a defeating device for subject matter jurisdiction, which means you could raise the claim 15 years later on a judgment that's already been entered and have it declared void ab initio. So I honestly question your limiting your reliance on the special versus the pure distinction, which is really a pleading and affirmative defense principle of waiver.
Okay. Well, the best answer I have for you is that, at least in the context of this statute, we know it's a pure and a waivable statute of limitations because you've already done so. In Columbia Paper, another tax case, this court accepted a government waiver of a tax case under a very similar statute. I mean, it was from 1914 code, so it's not exact, of course. But you couldn't have reached that conclusion if the government was unable to waive, because in that case, the government was saying, well, we waive, but...
Let me restate it one more time. If you have a, let's say, a true special statute of limitations, the right is intrinsically bound up with the limitation period, like a statute of repose, for example. Mm-hmm. And that means you've got to raise it if you're a defendant. And if you don't raise it, it's waived, and it can't be raised for the first time on appeal. The next step, though, is... A limitation period that somehow withdraws subject matter jurisdiction of the tribunal. Subject matter jurisdiction, not active jurisdiction. In which case, not only do you waive it by not raising it at that moment, not only do you not waive it at that moment, you can raise it 15 years later, after the judgment, in a collateral attack on the prior judgment, because it's subject matter jurisdiction defeating. Is that the consequence we attach to special statutes of limitations? And if so, is there any case saying that?
Well, just Kelsey, the truthful answer, I don't know. I know in the context of this case, in a tax case, it can be waived because it has been waived. In this case, the substantive part of the law is 1101, which is in a totally separate subtitle. From the remedy, which is 3981.1, and all your cases where you find that statute of limitations is not waivable in jurisdiction, and it is jurisdiction-based, you've always held that the right and the remedy are combined. All the cases cited by both sides have examples of that where the right and the remedy are combined, unlike the case that we have here. But even if the statute of limitations is not waivable, and if Horrible did not waive, we timely filed for both 2008 and 2009 under the theory that when Horrible took his second look and did a new assessment, that was itself a new assessment. And we had 90 days thereafter to appeal the tax commissioner, so we were timely. I'm getting that from a public document 1144 from the tax commissioner, who clearly said that a denial of a refund claim.
It seems like that would be a radical overhaul of how these things are handled. I mean, you may be right, but to say the denial of an assessment is a new assessment that triggers a new period, I mean, I just have never seen that kind of thing.
Well, Justice McCullough, it makes a lot of sense because Horrible could have done two things. He could have put his hand up and saying, no, I'm not going to look at it because there's no requirement for me to do so. I'm not going to look at it. In which case, we might be in a different place in this case. But that's not what he did. He took a second look, and his conclusion was the same tax result as the first time. But his conclusion could have been, I'm going to tax Verizon more money. I made a mistake. I taxed you too little. Or I'm not going to refund you all the money, but I'm going to refund some of it. If I don't have this mechanism, and this isn't a new assessment, then at that point I'm stuck.
But that's not what happened. So maybe that's a stronger argument if you get a new amount that you're fighting about. But if it's just what's the same thing, I'm sticking with my prior assessment. How is that a new assessment?
Well, Well, because the law required him to put in his independent mind thought. I mean, it's not, the law doesn't anticipate that a public official is going to just be a rubber stamp to a prior decision. I mean, we expected, and I'm sure that they did, a second look to make an independent decision. And once a public official makes an independent decision, the fact that the independent decision becomes the same as the first time doesn't eliminate my right to appeal any more than it would have if he raised my taxes or disagreed with
someone. Could someone come back 20 years later and say, I want a redo, and the commissioner says, No, I'm sticking with my original assessment. Would that work?
No, at that point I'd completely be stuck because that's what Horrible could have done in this case theoretically. We would have been in a very different posture today. We could have gone to Commissioner Horrible. He said, "Nope, I'm not. Toss of the hand. I'm not going to look at this because it's there's no requirement for me to do so, and I'm not going to do it." But that's not what he did. He did a second look, and that second look is a new assessment. We also are timely under 58.13980, the three-year statute of limitations, under that same theory that this is a new assessment, because the final determination was July 14, 2011. That itself was a new assessment. On January 10, 2013, within the three-year period, Horrible had appealed to the circuit court, and we filed an affirmative defense of the raising statute of limitations, and that was squarely before the circuit court. Now, I can understand someone saying, well, wait a minute, the law says that you have to appeal within 3 years. In this case, Horrible appealed within 3 years, and you filed an affirmative defense. But it's the same, we're at the same place. I mean, we're before the judge on exactly the same issue and exactly the same decision maker. And I think that certainly fits the spirit of the law. So either under either of those two paths, we're timely. But even if you don't think that I'm timely on either of those theories or the issue about what I was just talking about, we were clearly timely for 2009. The initial assessment was April 16, 2009. We filed on December 28, 2010, which is within the one-year statute of limitations period. And if that were the end of the analysis, there would be nothing to talk about. We clearly made the one-year statute of limitations. Now, Horrible says, but you didn't tell us everything that you wanted to appeal in your notice to us. The statute requires a number of things. And he said you didn't state the dollar amount you were seeking or the remedy that you were seeking. And so, therefore, that really wasn't an appeal, and you missed your statute of limitations when you subsequently corrected it.
But didn't that also have a statement from Verizon that more information was going to be forthcoming?
We did.
And so if you're the commissioner, you think, okay, well, I'm just going to wait around because obviously this is a placeholder and we're going to deal with this later. How does that affect the analysis?
Well, the placeholder is the deadline fulfillment. I mean, I guess it's a good analogy.
Maybe like amending a pleading.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. And in this instance,
Counsel, can you come back to this new assessment discussion that you're having with Justice McCullough? Once Mr. Horrible has made a decision, your position is that new decision is a new assessment.
That is our position.
So with it being a new assessment, are you arguing that you get a new 3-year period?
Correct.
As opposed to the 90 days that the statute allows?
Correct, because it's a new assessment under either of the two paths, the one-year statute of limitations under 3981.1 or the 3 years under 3980. That is our position.
But the code provides you have 90 days to appeal that assessment to the commissioner. Why would the code give you 90 days if you have 3 years?
Because there are different paths. One is 90 days to the commissioner, or we could have filed 3 years from that point to directly to the circuit court. I see I only have a minute left. May I reserve the balance of my time?
Yes.
Thank you.
Please the court, Michael Cherno. First, I'd like to point out that if you decide to set top boxes and machines, you don't have to decide this issue. The taxpayer in any case has three options, actually, not two. One is under 3984, take the matter straight to court, and that's within 3 years of the last day of the year of the assessment. Or the taxpayer can go to the Commissioner of Revenue under 3980 for any tax, and that's also within 3 years of the last day of the year of assessment. Or under this special section that's been created, that's at issue here, 3983.1, for business taxes only, the taxpayer can go to the Commissioner of Revenue within 1 year. This case started with the letter that is referred to by Mr. Oblon. It's found at the appendix at 373, and it was on December 28, 2010. And I think what is clear when you look at that letter is that it reveals that Verizon clearly knew that it was too late to be coming to the Commissioner of Revenue under 3983.1, at least for 2008, we contend for 2009, because it was factually deficient. But Verizon knew it was too late because it said it was bringing the appeal under 3980, which is the three-year appeal period for all 3 years. So it knew at that point in time that it wasn't going to be able to go to the State Tax Commissioner, at least for 2008, and that if it wanted to protect its rights, it was going to need to go to the circuit court. And it still had time to go to circuit court, and it still had time to go to circuit court even after Mr. Horrible ruled finally on the substance of the matter. It chose not to do that. That is not Mr. Horrible's fault. And his obligation under the code is simply to advise the taxpayer of their right to appeal to the tax commissioner under subsection D of 3983.1, not to advise the taxpayer of every legal remedy the taxpayer may have, including suing him in circuit court.
On the 2009 assessment, can a failure to include some of the details that the statute calls for be harmless? And is it harmless in this case?
Your Honor, I would say no. I think when the remedy is laid out in the statute and it clearly says what the requirements of an appeal must include, failure to include details, meet the requirements of the statute, I would argue is fatal. And I think...
When you say fatal, do you mean fatal in terms of void ab initio and thus... the state commissioner has no subject matter jurisdiction to review the matter?
Yes, sir. I do.
What Virginia case says that? I understand all the cases that distinguish between the special and the pure statute of limitations, but they're dealing with the duty to assert an affirmative defense in a proceeding and the burden of proof, actually. They're not dealing with subject matter jurisdiction. They're dealing with active jurisdiction.
Well, first of all, as we cited in our briefs, this court has held for a long time when the remedy is established by the statute and in tax cases and the time period is included in that remedy provided to the taxpayer, it's incumbent upon the taxpayer to meet that requirement too late. And
let's follow the logic of that for a second. And putting aside tax cases, let's say there is a flat-out special statute of limitations associated with some cause of action. The right of action is created by the statute. The statute incorporates the limitation period intrinsically into the right of action, so we don't have a debate on that. And a plaintiff sues, and a defendant fails to raise the obvious statute of limitations and gets a judgment for the plaintiff. Plaintiff gets a judgment. 20 years later, the defendant can come in and say, I know I never raised the special statute of limitations defense, but it rendered the 20 years earlier judgment void ab initio and all the money that's been paid in the interim I want restitution of. Where's the case that says that? Because that's the missing issue in this debate.
Well, I think the premise of the argument is that we have this 801-235 that applies.
There's no doubt that's the lead argument, that the statute says what it says, and it does say what it says. But there's a bigger conceptual problem with even using pure versus special, because unless you can demonstrate it goes to subject matter jurisdiction, it can be waived. jurisdictional matters that are not subject matter jurisdiction, that we use the term active jurisdiction, they can all be waived. Only subject matter jurisdiction can't be waived.
And we've taken the position that this is essentially the subject matter jurisdiction, at least with respect to the commissioner, the tax commissioner of the state. But the whole premise that 801 through 35 might apply really, I think, is faulty, because obviously Title 801 deals with court proceedings and civil remedies in court. There are no pleadings that are filed in an administrative case. There are no affirmative offenses that the Commissioner of Revenue is obligated to express. It's an informal administrative procedure governed by the regulations. And that's why also it really makes no sense for Verizon to rely on these tax bulletins that say a denial of a refund is starts the whole time.
Did Commissioner Horvell ever raise the statute of limitations issue in the administrative process prior to circuit court?
He did not.
All right. So isn't there another procedural default issue that sounds like the ones you all are talking about, but actually is not at all? And this basically the 5A18 and the 525 principle when we're dealing between courts, lower courts and appellate courts. The Court of Appeals in three published opinions, including one in bank opinion, has held, and there's been no dispute, at least in the Court of Appeals, we've not addressed it, that judicial review of administrative proceedings, the same underlying concepts of waiver that we codified in 5A18 and 525 still apply. So therefore, the loser in the administrative proceeding can't raise new issues to attack the loss in the circuit court review action for the first time in the circuit court. It's simply, you didn't raise it then, it can't be raised now.
Well, I would contend that if you look at the statute that applies here, Commissioner Horvell wasn't even given an opportunity to raise this issue. The way the structure is laid out for ways are processed, the appeal goes to the state tax commissioner. The very first issue the tax commissioner has to resolve is whether he has jurisdiction.
Well, I mean, it was never argued. It was, you filed a 35-page brief and with exhibits, but no one ever said to the tax commissioner, you have no power to hear this case. I know you've decided preliminarily you do, but you didn't. So now the only question is the commissioner's exercise of power ultra vires under subject matter jurisdiction principles, and thus the procedural default of not raising it in administrative pre-litigation context is insignificant.
I would say it's ultra vires, and the tax commissioner, state tax commissioner, had no authority to issue a refund.
No authority or no power?
No power.
Okay.
With respect to the issue of the denial of the refund being a separate appealable action, the tax bulletins, as this court has said, really have no weight unless the tax commissioner incorporates those into administrative regulations. And if you do look at the administrative regulations in this case, you can see that it's true that a request for a refund might trigger another appealable opportunity, but the way you file a refund is by filing amended returns. And that did not happen in this case. There was no amended return. This was the very first request for a second look, and there were no amended returns filed. And also, under the administrative regulations, it says that even an amended return is not going to be treated as a separate appealable assessment unless you're raising new facts that weren't previously considered. So because the Commissioner Horvell really had no opportunity to weigh in on the jurisdictional issue, because that's what the tax commissioner decides. And the tax commissioner has issued in other cases rulings where he has said...
In that lengthy brief that was filed, there was just no possibility to raise this basic issue? I don't understand that.
It was not raised, that's correct.
No, but I understand it wasn't raised, but I don't understand the point that there was no opportunity to raise it. Well, I mean, why not throw in a couple of paragraphs and say, look, they're just untimely. You got to address that.
Well,
first.
I guess it's possible that we could have done that, but technically, if you looked at the statute, by accepting the appeal, the tax commissioner has already decided the jurisdictional issue.
Right, but the tax commissioner could be wrong. And if you want to protect your position, then I think you probably have to. I mean, we can sua sponte, and we do raise questions of jurisdiction, but that doesn't mean the parties can't raise it.
And we did not raise it in the brief. That's true. What Verizon is essentially arguing is that Horrible and the Commissioner of Revenue's offices should be a stop from asserting this at this point. And estoppel does not apply to local governments. That's been established by this court. Its efforts to couch it in terms of waiver or consent or failure to preserve really just do not apply under the statute.
But local governments, as litigants, are subject to 5A18 in the Court of Appeals and 525 here, and the proposition that you have to exhaust your available defenses in the administrative proceeding when you're seeking judicial review of administrative proceedings is nothing but that same principle. So why would there be any prohibition on applying those procedural default principles to municipalities or municipal agents?
Well,
or
the
constitutional
court
officers?
Has said that estoppel is not applicable to...
It's not estoppel, it's simply procedural default.
Well, Your Honor, I just think under the procedure, there is no real opportunity for the commissioner to have raised the defense, even under the administrative regulations that govern the tax appeals. It says specifically that taxpayers are not obligated to exhaust any administrative remedies. It's really an administrative remedy for the taxpayer, not the commissioner of revenue. So it's really not a process that's really... It's afforded to the Commissioner of Revenue, although he obviously has the opportunity to participate. He's not obligated under any rules of the regulations to essentially...
So what would happen if the taxpayer lost with the state commissioner and then seeks judicial review and then raises an argument in the judicial review action that has never been raised by the taxpayer in the administrative side of the dispute? Would you not say you can't raise it for the first time in the circuit court de novo review?
Honestly, I don't think I could do that. I don't think the taxpayer is obligated to, in that administrative process, to raise every complaint that it has. It can go straight to court. It doesn't even have to follow the administrative process. It can go straight to court.
But if it's appealing the state commissioner's holding, it doesn't have to raise the challenges to the state commissioner's holding to the state commissioner prior to going to court?
The standard is whether it was error, whether the state tax commissioner was erroneous. And I don't think necessarily that the taxpayer, that you're bound basically by the record established through this informal administrative process. Thank you. Are there no other questions?
Rebuttal. You have a minute and 6 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Because I only have 1 minute, I just wanted to conclude with 2009 and in response to Justice McCullough's question about harmless error. We think that it would be, that any error would be harmless in this instance. Because when we reported to the commissioner that we were seeking a correction, a review, we cited the Comcast case. And the Comcast case, in our letter, the Comcast case was something that Horrible was very well familiar with because he was a party in Comcast. The Comcast case was also in Chesterfield. It was the same county, the same issue regarding cable converters. It just involved a different company. So everybody knew what we were talking about. We wanted a refund for our converters. And Verizon reported only converters. That's the only thing we had to report. And so everybody knew what we were asking for. We were asking for a refund on the converters, and we were asking for 100% because that's the only thing we had reported. And I ask that you reverse the trial court and order refunds for 2008 and 2009.
All right. Thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 11 a.m.